first, thanks for the invitation. And the reason I changed the title is just because I noticed that each of the little sections I'll be presenting have a lot to do with something called the decoherence versus diffusion trade-off, which I'll explain, and the saturation of it. So this is joint work with some of my students and former students, Isaac Layton, Carlos Barrecchieri, Barbara Segura, and Zach Weller Davies, who's here. And the and what I guess if people can just interrupt with questions, I guess I have a bit more of a slide talk, but I'm happy to kind of go to the blackboard at any point if there's particular things that are of interest, and especially David, if there's things that are maybe unfamiliar to you, some of these things may have been seen before by some. Good. So the question I'm going to ask is. We have two major frameworks for in physics. We have quantum mechanics and we have classical mechanics. They look like they have a very similar form. This is the Heisenberg equation involving the density matrix sigma with the Hamiltonian H. And this is the Liouville equation, which governs the evolution of the phase space density. And so we can have a quantum state and a point in phase space and ask, can these two things talk to each other? Can they interact? Is it possible? We have these two frameworks. Is there any way they can be compatible with each other? Now, of course, we do this all the time in one sense. We're always studying particles in potentials, and that potential is the potential produced by a classical system. And so it's very easy to have classical systems push on quantum systems. And an example is this double slit experiment, for example, where the walls are treated classically, they push back on the quantum particles, so that we can do. What we can't do at the moment, what's generally believed impossible to do is to consider the back reaction of the quantum system on the classical system. So that's what I'll be discussing, and that's why the original title was about the back reaction. It's difficult to understand how we should consider back reaction of quantum systems on classical. There's been a long debate about whether this is possible going up to, until quite recently, back and forth. I think most strongly put forward the no by Feynman and Hernoff. Nonetheless, since the mid-90s, we have had already consistent theories of quantum systems coupled to classical ones. So Blanchard and Jagic and Dioshi was kind of the first examples of such theories in the mid-90s. And there's kind of a long history of people trying to use these equations. There's experiments to probe the quantum nature of gravity. There's something called the semi-classical Einstein equation, which is used in gravity, but is inconsistent. And people use various models in the theory of quantum chemistry, for example, which are not, need to the negative probabilities, but they're valid in some regime.
Sorry, ones that lead to negative probabilities, that doesn't feel like a quantum classical coupling. That feels more like sometimes this quantum theory admits of a classical interpretation, but when the probabilities go negative, it doesn't.
Yeah, I would say that.
Okay, but then there's a whole literature on stuff like that, which is, a bunch of quantum foundations is about figuring out what aspects of quantum predictions admit of classical explanations.
I wouldn't say that this is kind of the opposite, right? It's like, when can a quantum description, when can a quantum description admit a classical description?
When can a Bell experiment admit a local realist model? When can this experiment admit a non-conductual model? Like that's not the same spirit, is it not?
Sorry?
That's the same spirit, yeah?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think that's a literature where you're trying to understand the difference between classical and quantum dynamics, whereas this whole literature on, say, using what's called the AG bracket, the Alexandrov bracket, or Koopman's formulation. Yeah. their goal is to do quantum chemistry. So they're just actually have a, experiments they're trying to do. They're trying to look at reaction rates, and they're just computing reaction rates. And so they want to, they have an equation, they make some approximations. They don't pay too much attention. I mean, they're maybe not so concerned if the equations are not consistent, as long as it gives them sensible answers in the scenarios that they're interested in. So for example, you can have a dynamics which is completely positive on some input states, but not on all. And if they are, those are the input states they're interested in, then they're not bothered by the fact that it's not a consistent dynamics. So I feel like, given the audience, you can see why I have to motivate this research. And I guess my motivation comes both from the question I asked at the beginning, which is that it's clearly, it seems to be a fundamental question, can we couple these two frameworks? They're the only two ones we have, and it feels like an important question, whether they can be coupled. Other motivations come from understanding gravity. We either would want to understand it as an effective theory, because we're often in the limit where gravity can be treated classically, and yet we still want to understand things like vacuum fluctuations in the early universe. So we might be interested in it as an effective theory. We might just be interested in it too as a toy theory for understanding quantum gravity, because we can construct this consistent theory of gravity, and it's interesting to see what sort of phenomena we can reproduce and where the similarities, you know, often we encounter something in this classical quantum theory, which is much simpler in the classical quantum theory than it would be in quantum theory. So it provides a nice kind of toy theory or model as well, sandbox in which to study quantum gravity. And finally, I'm interested in, as a possible candidate for a fundamental theory. That's maybe my primary motivation, because I think it's at least possible that gravity should not be quantized, and there are nearish terms experiments to probe that. So the results that I won't necessarily all present, but may I touch upon, is that we've able to derive the most general form of this dynamics. We find there are two classes of dynamics that are classical quantum, one which is continuous in phase space and one which has jumps. We're able to construct a theory of general relativity and quantum field theory using this formalism. And I guess what I'll maybe concentrate more on today is that we have this, we can have an interpretation of quantum mechanics where we get the Born rule for free. We don't need to have the measurement postulate. So I'll maybe spend a bit, I was only gonna spend one or two slides, but given the audience, I'll just maybe jump sooner to that. And finally, there's this decoherence versus diffusion trade-off, which I will talk about, and which allows us to consider near-term experiments.
So just to make sure I haven't lost you yet, you said there's all these other papers where you have pathologies in some limits or negative probabilities in other cases, but you're saying that you actually have a framework which is consistent. Maybe it's hard to compute with, but it is doesn't lead to any of these pathologies.
That's right.
And then you're going to apply it for a few actual cases.
It's more like, I'll give an outline of what I'll do. I think what I'd like to do, and maybe I'm happy to kind of play, I feel like I can jump to things if someone is more interested in something, but the first thing I was going to talk about is why people think it's inconsistent, like the original argument of Aronov and Feynman. And that we can quantify, we can instead of thinking of it as so it turns out it's not, there's a loophole in their argument, and that you can quantify that loophole, and this leads to this decoherence versus diffusion trade-off. So we can quantify that, and that enables us to test gravity. So that's kind of, I will discuss why people thought it was impossible and how you can get around it. And then I was gonna tell the story of, this dynamics through the eyes of path integrals, just because you very nicely, in the path integral, you can see that there is the standard Feynman path integral for quantum systems. There's the Feynman-Vernon path integral for open quantum systems. There's classical path integrals in stochastic dynamics, and then you can see how they combine in a very nice way. So I thought I would tell that story so that you can see the kind of how classical path integrals, quantum path integrals, and these classical quantum path integrals all relate to each other and have a very kind of interesting overlapping. And then I'll talk about the kind of a tentative attempt at using this to say something about the foundations. Is that? I don't know. If, I don't need to get to the GR theory, but I, if we have time, I'll flash up the slide. I could.
Would your coupling framework be an alternative to what's currently being used for chemistry?
Sorry? Yes, it would be. Okay, so let's do the first part, which is why. So this is why people thought you could not couple quantum theory and classical theory. I'll go through it quickly because I think most some of you have seen it. So I'll go through it quickly. So the argument is as follows. We do a double slit experiment with a heavy particles. So we're going to do a double slit experiment, say with the moon. We do the double slit experiment. We get an interference pattern. But while the particles are traversing the box, we try and measure its gravitational field. It could be any field. So this is Feynman's argument of why the gravitational field has to be quantized, okay, why we have to quantize it. And he said the reason we have to quantize it is because if we're measuring, if we're using gravity like this pendulum and this gravity wave detector to measure where the particle is, then the gravitational field is classical. The gravitational field will be different depending on which slit the particle went through. So as the particle is going through the right slit, it's moving, it's exerting a force on the gravitational field. And because we can measure the gravitational field exactly, we'll be able to determine which slit the particle went. And therefore, there can't be an interference pattern. Because if there was an interference pattern, that is inconsistent with knowing which slit the particle went through. Is that argument clear?
So as you framed it, it was an argument. This is supposed to be an argument against the existence of any consistent classical quantum coupling theory.
Well, it's obviously not because there's a loophole to this argument, but it's...
That's what it was meant to be, because it didn't sound like it was that. Like, you didn't stipulate exactly which degrees of freedom. Like, you're saying that because it's meant to show that the gravitational degrees of freedom have to be quantum, because
that was the argument, yeah.
Because otherwise, we wouldn't see interference. Like,
that's right.
So the argument works by assuming that if you did this experiment with the moon, it would come out the way quantum theory says.
Well, and the electron as well. Like, the electron has a assuming that the electron has a gravitational field, which it ought to, and so we see interference experiments with electrons. So clearly, electrons are not pushing.
Because the gravitational influence of the electron between this slit or this slit presumably would not be strong enough to decohere it. It might bring the interference fringe visibility down a tiny bit, but it seems to me like the scales are important here. Like, if you want to say, and we observe that the interference does not get distorted in the way that a classical interaction suggests,
right,
then obviously we can't rely on an interference experiment with the moon nor with an electron, right?
Well, no. So I guess the argument would be that because the gravitational field is different, is actually different depending on which slit it went through, at say the time that it's going through, then it's got to put an imprint on the gravitational field, and that will always be different.
Right.
And their argument was too classic. I mean, so the reasoning, this is Yakir and Feynman, their reasoning is they didn't think of stochastic theory, so their reasoning is the gravitational field has to be different. And since the gravitational field can be measured exactly, there can be no interference fringe whatsoever.
So if we put our own external field to sort of try to track which slit it goes through, then yeah, we can break the interference pattern. But there's always a magnetic field, right? Like, the Earth has a magnetic field. And so, like...
Good. So here is the moon with its electromagnetic, getting entangled with the environment or the electromagnetic field, as you just said. Now, there's two differences that happen. One is that if I were to during say the period where the moon is here, right? It's entangled with the electromagnetic field. Some people say it's dressed, okay? It has all these virtual photons, if you want to think in that language, coming from it. If I were to, now, this state is actually maximally entangled, all right? It's maximally entangled. If I were to measure the electromagnetic field while the particle is moving across the box, I would, by just measuring the electromagnetic field, I would know which slit it was going through, had gone through, and I will disturb the interference pattern by measuring not the electron, but the electromagnetic field. You can argue whether those are different or not, but I think there's a clear sense in which I'm
with a sufficiently strong measurement here.
Right. The difference is that for a classical field, I can, but it'll disturb the electron if I do that. It completely disturbs the electron, the electromagnetic field, and I just destroy the interference pattern. On the other hand, for a classical field, I can measure that to arbitrary accuracy with no disturbance whatsoever. Right? And so, you know, in the middle of the box, this thing is, it's not entangled because it's a classical field, but it's put its imprint on the classical field. I can measure it during its traversal of the box, and I will know which slit it went through before it hits the screen without disturbing it. That's the contradiction.
Here you're talking about the disturbance to the particle, not to the field.
Right. Well, so no, it's the field that, so if I just measure the field,
yes.
You know, I am just, you know, I'm basically breaking the entanglement between the thing and, you know, this is like, I guess people would call fake decoherence sometimes, or the electron gets entangled with its electromagnetic field. It's, I mean, it's always dressed with its electromagnetic field. It's, and then it comes here and hits the screen. Now, if the electron was here going through the other screen, it goes here, and when it hits the screen, the amount of entanglement has gone to zero by the time the electron hits the screen, right? Like that information gets recorded in the electromagnetic field and gets erased once it hits the screen. There may be some residual entanglement between the electron and the electromagnetic field. For example, if some Bremsstrahlung got emitted, then there'll be some residual entanglement. And that will lead to what you said. That will lead to a little bit of destruction of the interference. So there will be some entanglement with the environment by the time the electron hits the screen. And so it's crucial for that kind of entanglement. That's, you know, this is the long, sometimes called the long field. It's crucial for that sort of entanglement that the different states of the electromagnetic field, even though they're different depending on whether the molecule went through the left or the right, they're different, but they still have very large overlap. So they're distinct, but they have large overlap. So if I were to construct the density matrix, given that the electromagnetic field is in the right state or the left state, then they have a lot of overlap, and so I can have a lot of coherence and have an interference pattern. But this is the, for example, the final density matrix will be, this is the final field after the electron has hit the slit. On the other hand, before the electron has hit the slit, when it's in the middle here, and when these paths are not overlapping, then the electromagnetic field is actually very different in both cases and highly entangled with my electron. It's only when it hits the screen and is at the same point in space in both cases, depending on whether it went on the left or the right, that it has erased most of the information, at least, that was contained in the electromagnetic field.
Maybe you could just clarify something for me. Like, you started on these slides trying to summarize Feynman's argument.
Right.
Presumably, one of Feynman's assumptions was the electromagnetic field does not get a Hilbert, or the gravitational field does not get a Hilbert space. And so, one, you know, if you're trying to prove an Ovo theorem, you know, not to write down a formula like that one, because that presumes that your field does admit of a quantum description.
Right.
So this is, you've moved on now from the Ovo theorem, and now you're talking about if you.
Well, now I'm talking about why.
This is what it looks like.
I'm giving a slide where, in response to the question, well, what about the electromagnetic field? What happens with the electromagnetic field? And what happens with the electromagnetic field is that there is some, you know, the electromagnetic field is left in a different state depending on whether the particle went through the left or the right. But the electromagnetic field, but it has high overlap in both cases, and so we still see interference pattern.
And the critical thing is that we're allowing the electromagnetic field to be quantum here.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a notion of two non states of the electromagnetic field, whereas in the assumption that was being made in the Ovo theorem, there's no such thing as non-orthogonality. All states are perfectly distinguishable. therefore, any distinction in the field destroys the interference completely. That was the argument, yes?
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, good.
And actually, I should say that you know, it's great to read that argument in the Chapel Hill conference. It's available online. There's this interesting discussion. It makes for a beautiful read. What I'm giving is not actually Feynman's argument. It's a souped-up version of that, I think, partly or mostly due to Erna. Good. So I think Rob hit on it, which is that when we think of deterministic classical systems or states, what we think of is that if we have two distinct classical states, they have no overlap. They are orthogonal. You know, you're at this point in phase space or you're at this point in phase space, and there's no overlap. However, what we can have we can have probability distributions over classical states. So if when the molecule goes through the left slit and the molecule goes through the right slit, if those two correspond to different classical states of the gravitational field, if those states are probability distributions over possible configurations, then you can have it that there's two classical states, in other words, probability distributions, which are different, depending on whether the molecule went through the left or the right, but which have overlap, right? And therefore, because they have overlap, and because when measuring the classical field, you will not learn which slit the electron went through, there can still be an interference pattern. Is that clear? So here, I've drawn a bad thing of, I have this electron, it's going from slit right down into the, going onto the screen. Here is a cartoon of what's happening to the gravitational field. When the electron goes through the right slit, it pushes the gravitational field in one direction. When the electron goes through the other slit, it pushes the gravitational field in the other direction with some force, given by F here. And so it's pushing, that's the back reaction. It's pushing the electromagnetic field with a force in one direction or the other direction, depending on whether it went through the left or right slit. But because these are distributions and it's noisy, so you have it's a distribution of possible gravitational fields, they can have some overlap. And if they have some overlap, then there can be interference.
So just to be clear, the x-axis of this plot is the strength of the electromagnetic field at some particular point in space.
So this is the momentum. So what I'm plotting here is the momentum of the gravitational field. This is just a cartoon, a one-dimensional gravitational field.
Okay, the momentum of the the electromagnetic field.
Yeah, so it's getting pushed to the left or the right. And what I'm plotting here is the probability of the field being
different
momentum states. And so there is the force on the momentum, which is how quickly these peaks are getting pushed away. There's the time of coherence, like how long is the screen? How long am I keeping these electrons coherent? And so that is the coherence time. And the diffusion here, D2, is the width of these peaks. So the larger the width of the peaks, the harder it is to tell these two peaks apart, and I'm more likely to get interference. If the force is very large and pushing the peaks far apart very quickly, then I also will very quickly learn whether the particle went through the left and right slit. So that will also cause short coherence times. And so there's a trade-off between the force that the particle the force is placing, the back reaction force on the gravitational field, the diffusion, and the coherence time. There's a trade-off between those three things, and this is what we call the decoherence versus diffusion trade-off.
More questions. So usually I think about this experiment in terms of just the Coulomb field, which I wouldn't normally associate a momentum with. Do we have this particle going to the interferometer and accelerating and generating radiation, which then has a momentum, or am I just how do you define
it? Right, so this is the momentum, and again, this is a cartoon, you can do it more carefully for a field, because what we're talking, this is, but it's the momentum of the gravitational field itself. So it's a bit confusing. It's not the force of gravity, it's the force that the electron pushes on the gravitational field. Likewise with Coulomb potential, if you electron moves, originally the electromagnetic field is say zero here. When the electron gets close, pushes the electromagnetic field, and so it's exerting a force. It's a source, which is exerting a force on the electromagnetic field.
Okay, so you're saying if I have a Coulomb potential, like I don't have to think of like, okay, I have a charge, it generates Coulomb potential, but that is a time-varying Coulomb potential because the charge is moving around. Right. So you're saying I can model a time-varying Coulomb potential in the language of momentum of the electromagnetic field, where sort of the rate of change of the Coulomb potential somehow at every point defines a momentum.
Sure. Your phase-based degrees of freedom are, you know, your A and B field, and you can... not commonly done, but you can do that. Because usually we're interested in the statics. We're, you know, we're usually solving Gauss's law, so we're actually solving the constraint of electromagnetism.
Okay.
But certainly.
This feels like coupling a quantum system to a like toy bit. Because you're positing classicality of the field, but still allowing it to have epistemic states, which are...
No, so one can do that. We could talk about that. But here, I mean, it's just a classical probability distribution. You can know it, you know, I can measure the field. I can measure the point in phase. I know what point in phase space it is. It's just that because it's produced stochastically, I'm not able to relate that point to the, to what the quantum state is. So it's just a normal classical probability distribution. There's no epistemic restriction here. It's not unnatural to have epistemic restrictions, so I'd be happy to talk about that. It comes about if the thing is creating diffusion in Q and P, then you can get an epistemic restriction.
Maybe what Elliot was saying is that in your approach, the analog to non-orthogonality in the classical sphere is overlap of probability distribution, which is precisely what occurs in psi-epistemic models as well, that the analog non-orthogonality of quantum states is degree of overlap of probability distributions.
Sure. I mean,
you're using that to sort of evade Feynman's argument.
Sure. I mean, I would just say this is ordinary, like, you know, these sorts of relations come about when you're just trying to infer data from, you know, you have some classical data you're trying to infer. Was it zero or one? So you're just trying to learn from some classical data. In this case, you're trying to look, you're basically, you know, this is telling you how quickly can you learn by looking at the classical data. There's a force and there's a diffusion. How quickly can you learn whether it went through the left or the right? As soon as you've learned whether it went through the left or right, then it's gone. You're both looking in the sky like you have a question.
So, are you describing here a very explicit model of how a quantum system couples to a classical field?
Right.
That, you know, different quantum states lead to different distributions? Because you just said something that sounded definitive, like how quickly, you know, the fringe visibility goes away depends on that. That sounds like you need to specify a lot more details than you've
right.
told us thus far.
Right.
That was more like...
Yeah, so I'm giving you Right, right. So I'm giving you just like a heuristic. I feel like this is something I can tell you in words and it's understandable why, like I want to give you an intuition as to why classical quantum couplings have to have this property. I want to give you that intuition. The actual derivation of this trade-off comes about because you say what's the most general form of the dynamics you can have, which couples classical and quantum and preserves probability and is completely positive trace preserving? What's the most general form of the dynamics? And then you find that in order to preserve positivity, it has to satisfy this trade-off. Are there questions about this? Because I feel like this is...
You actually didn't ever define D0 or D1.
Right.
So you've been focusing on the top of the slide. I have no questions about that. You've been pointing to the bottom of the slide as if you just explained that.
Right. Good. So here is the trade-off. I have the so I'll just leave it at this that we are going to write the trade-off in terms of the coherence times that we have in the lab. The force being the back reaction that the electron induces on the classical field and the diffusion in the classical field, I will just tell you that we can write down a most general form of the master equation, which couples classical and quantum dynamics, and we can write down this trade-off, which is in terms of just some coupling constants, which are, have to occur in the theory. And one is called the drift, D1 is called the drift, D0 is related to how fast you decohere, and D2 is the diffusion in the classical field. And so that's the trade-off in couplings between the decoherence, the diffusion, and the force, the back reaction.
Is the drift D1 related to the force? Because it seems like the force tells you how to the peak moves, which sounds...
Yeah, the drift is the force.
I see. So D1 and F expectation are the same thing here.
No, so these are coupling... Sorry, yeah, this is like... F is like the expectation value of G1. Well...
And sorry, D0 again with the decoherence rate. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's related to tau. So tau is also basically some function of D0. They're simply related.
Yeah, so these are the what you want to do is we first derive the master equation, the most general master equation that you can have for classical quantum dynamics. Given that master equation, we can have a trade-off in terms of coupling constants, and then we want to relate it to physical observables like the so tau is related to D0, but not exactly. It can actually depend on some other things, and that's actually the difficulty when we want to do experiments, which is that its difficulty is relating in these things to the master equation. Are there any other questions? Oh, okay, I didn't get that one. So there you can see the force is how far the peak is, the width of the peak is D2. Good. So all I want to say is that what we're trying to understand now is that we can actually perform experiments now to rule out some of these theories. Namely, we can do double slit experiments to get to measure the coherence time. We can do Cavendish experiments to measure, to have precision measurements of the gravitational field, and we need to have diffusion in the gravitational field. So we'll either find that these Cavendish experiments see noise when they're trying to measure the mass of a kilogram, or we will see that, there's this trade-off, so we basically are squeezing the possible parameter space from both sides. Longer coherence time, squeeze it one way, less diffusion, squeeze it the other way, and we can use that to rule out certain models. So these are some of the modern experiments, and what we're able to do is we're able to rule out one of the classes of theories that we considered, but two other ones remain viable in quite a few orders of magnitude, but these are just like very preliminary envelope sketches to see if we can rule out some of these things. So we expect to be able to, just by being more careful, rule out a lot more of the parameter space.
Something I'm not following, which is it sounded like you're describing, we can use these two distinct types of experiments to put constraints on each of two different parameters. So it's not as if you're doing a double slit experiment close to a Cavendish experiment.
Right. So they're separate. And they may depend on different parameters. So you might be using, we advocate gold, using gold for the double slit experiments because density turns out to be important in some of these models.
Here's what I'm understanding, which is if you go back with the trade-off you're talking about, I thought D2, like the diffusion rate, kind of dependent on what system you're coupling.
Right,
with.
Right.
And so you measure diffusion rate in some Cavendish experiment where the other thing is not going on. You don't have the double slit. So what does that tell you about the diffusion rate when that's induced by your double slit experiment? Do you know what I mean?
I see what you mean, but if you construct this theory, it has coupling constants and it's decohering all the time. So when I'm measuring this mass, it is decohering the mass. You can't, it's linear. The theory is linear. It doesn't know if it's in superposition or not. So there's all this diffusion has to happen regardless of whether it's in superposition or not. So you can measure the diffusion independent of whether you're doing a double slit experiment with it or not.
I thought what you were suggesting earlier was that, the gravitational field will diffuse and drift and decohere by virtue of having just interacted with this particle. But now you're telling me, like, no, it just, it always diffuses. For instance, it has some natural diffusion, nothing to do with the fact that it's been generated by a particle in a double slit experiment. It just diffuses, and that's what sort of saves us from Feynman's argument, and we can't have possible quantum coupling. And we can go measure that diffusion rate just by doing a gravitational experiment.
Right.
Doing the double slit.
Right. So another word of saying it is, when this particle is in superposition, it needs to create a lot of diffusion. If I'm doing an interference experiment, it's in superposition. I see an interference pattern. I conclude that there must be a lot of diffusion in the gravitational field.
But now, creating, the moment you say creates diffusion, but it sounds to me like you want to say that diffusion is a natural process that happens for gravitational fields, and the fact that it happens is what allows the interference pattern to persist. No.
Sure. These may be semantics, whether you would say that this particle is causing the diffusion or not.
If it's causing diffusion, then why should I care what happens in a cavitation experiment? Because that's not the diffusion rate I care about.
I understand.
So which is it? I'm just too confused.
So when I say caused by it, that can be model dependent. So you can have models where diffusion happens all the time. Uh-huh. So there's diffusion happening over all space, at every point in space, independent of everything, and if that is the case, then it's just there, and that's actually this one which we're able to rule out. There's just too much diffusion being created, and we would have seen it in the Cavendish experiment. There are other models where the diffusion happens where there's mass. So that's what I mean by sometimes the particle can be causing the diffusion, because when it exerts the force on the gravitational field, that's when you get the diffusion. So there I might, this is just a, I'm just writing down some equations, so attributing some who's causing the diffusion is not, I don't think, terribly sensible, but the presence of mass can be causing diffusion. Diffusion can happen where there's mass. Now, because the theory is linear, it doesn't matter whether it's in superposition or not. It has to cause this diffusion all the time. It can't just be like, I'm in a superposition, I'm going to cause diffusion. No, it has to be doing it all the time.
Okay.
And so that's why you can go to the Cavendish experiment and look for this diffusion, because it has to be there, even because the particle doesn't know if it's in superposition.
So is the argument something like, okay, if I just do the Cavendish experiment, and I imagine doing it with firing an electron through it, no superposition, but just firing an electron through, because of linearity, the amount of diffusion generated by the electron being fired through would be the same as if it was, on half of a path and double slit. And then there's a final step where you say, and I don't even need to fire the electron through it because, there's lots of electrons around in the lab, and presumably one of them would be causing diffusion at the same rate as this electron flying through free space or whatever. Is that a step that you're sort of assuming?
I think you're constructing an argument which sounds reasonable to me, but which is not how we do it. I mean, we just write down the most general master equation. It has to have these coupling constants, and now you can just compute what happens. So there's no, argument to it. It's just pure this is the most general master equation we can write down. It has these coupling constants. They have to satisfy this trade-off.
Uh-huh.
And if you have these coupling constants, what will you observe in nature? Well, you will observe diffusion in these experiments.
It seems like you just went backwards again, because for a while you were agreeing that, the diffusion constant is not just something that's independent of the configuration. It depends on the configuration.
But the constant does...
You said, I can imagine situations where the presence or absence of an electron does impact the diffusion rate. And so I think what you can say is that, imagine those theories where the presence or absence of an electron or the mass does not impact the diffusion rate. I can get bounds on the coefficients of the diffusion rate for those theories by just looking at some Cavendish experiment. But you can't necessarily get bounds on the other types of theories where the diffusion rate does depend on the presence of a mass or electron, unless you say that the Cavendish experiment was done in the presence of the appropriate sorts of mass or whatever. You see what I mean? There's two classes.
Right. So maybe this will help. There are these different... So what we find is that there is a part in the master equation which has a D2, which is this diffusion coefficient, and then it has it's called a double Poisson bracket. So this is the diffusion, the Fokker-Planck term. So it looks like psi squared rho psi p squared. So that's what a in a master equation when I'm writing down if I were to have a master equation for the state, which I haven't yet said what it is yet, but I'm jumping ahead because of your question. But you know, what I do is I will find that it has some coefficient there, some coupling constant. And that coupling constant causes diffusion in P.
This is the row describing the momentum of the field.
Yeah, for example. Okay. And so, you know, there can be, there is very little freedom in the master equation. So there are two classes of theories, one which contains finite jumps, one which doesn't. You can treat them, you know, you can treat them separately. In the one, this I'm giving you one where it's, in the case where there's diffusion, sorry, where there's, which is continuous in phase space, it has to look like this. There can be no quantum operators near this term. And so what that means is that the diffusion cannot can depend on the properties of the gravitational field. So this could be, for example, coupled to, this could depend on the actual value. So D2 could depend on the actual value of the gravitational field, but it cannot depend on any properties of the particle. So in that case, you know, you don't need any particles there. There has to be diffusion regardless of the matter content of the field.
So that sounds like you just described those theories where
that's right.
The diffusion rate doesn't depend on the mass.
That's right. But it can inadvertently, because it's dependent on the, you know, can depend on the field. So when it depends on the field, it's kind of second order depending on the mass, because if a mass is there, it'll create a different gravitational field. And so, you know, it in some sense is feeling the masses around it, and diffusion will depend on that. So there are different models, and but there are not very many of them that are reasonable, and I've just listed three that we think are reasonable and rule out one of them, and we're trying to squeeze the other two.
Okay.
So that was, how are we for? Okay, so I will quickly go through path integrals then and then get to the foundations, which I think was the Mina Foundation seminar. So the reason I want to go through the path, so this joint work with Zach, we should put it on Weller Davies, we should put it on the archive within a couple days. And of the two of us, he's the brains behind this. And I think it gives a really nice, clear picture of how the classical quantum theory is related to other kinds of path integrals. So remember, we want to couple a point in phase space with a vector in a Hilbert space. Those are the states of the classical and quantum system. It's not going to be too important, actually, for what we're going to talk about in the path integral approach, but it's very easy to see what, in this case, what the classical quantum state is. You know, I have at every point in phase space, there is associated with it a quantum state, a ket, or a density matrix if it's not pure. So I can think that I have a probability distribution over points in, over each point in phase space, and given that I'm at a particular point in Q and P, there is a probability for the spin to be zero, a probability for the spin to be one, and a coherence, which is conditional on the point in phase space. So here is the classical quantum state, we call it. It lives on both Hilbert space and phase space, has a probability density of being at a point in phase space. Given that I'm at a particular point in phase space, I have a density matrix. Is the notion of a classical quantum state clear? Okay, and it has to be normalized, and it should be positive, just like the, you know, the quantum state has to be normalized, trace one, and it's a positive matrix. The phase space row has to be normalized and positive and integrate to one. And likewise, this thing is one, but I have to take the trace and integrate over phase space to see that it's normalized to one, and it's positive. And we've studied the possible dynamics, the general form of the dynamics, in a number of different ways. One way that is the you know, the, maybe the most familiar to people that are familiar with Lindblad equations or Fokker-Planck equations is to consider the master equation. You just say, what is the most general form of the dynamics, which is completely positive, trace preserving, and preserves the state space? Do people know what completely? I don't know how many people here are from, say, quantum foundations and information. Well, yeah. So in other words, the dynamics has to preserve probability. So because these things are positive and have trace one, it needs to preserve that property. So we need to preserve the state space. And that demand is what, you know, all these theories are consistent in that sense that they are completely positive trace preserved. Right? And you can do the master equation approach, trajectories approach, and I'll just talk about this recent path integral approach. So here's the path integral, the Feynman path integral. So I start off with some initial state. I mean, the state is in some initial state, say, phi I. Where's my hockey stick? And I want to compute the amplitude that it gets to some final state, phi f at some t final. And so what I do is I sum over all paths weighted by the action, and that's the Feynman path. Questions? And so we can also, it's less often done, but it's just easy to see that you can do it. I can also, if I don't want to just compute the amplitude, but I want to compute the density matrix, I have two path integrals, right? So here I have my initial state, the bra and the ket at time ti. I want to know what any element of the density matrix looks like. So I can sandwich it between a different bra and ket. So one is called the minus phi minus ket, one is called the phi plus ket. So I've doubled the number of fields. And now I have two path integrals. They're just independent of each other. So just like a path integral for this, for the bra, and a path integral for the ket, right? And so this is the doubled path integral where I now have to sum over the fields for the bra and fields for the ket enabled by plus minus. And because one is conjugate, it comes in with a minus sign. Question.
Just not parsing about this equation. If the final phi plus and phi minus happen to be equal, then on the left hand side, I'd be like, now I'm just looking at a diagonal term. It should give me the probability. But if I look at the right hand side of this equation, it looks like the actions up there and the exponent are now going to cancel, and I'm always going to get the same probability regardless of what phi is.
No, so it's only true that at the endpoints they happen to be the same, but any other point they don't have to be. So now I have just two different. I'm just computing two independent path integrals.
I see.
So you're computing an independent path integral for the ket and an independent path integral for in the case of the diagonal ones, you're just computing the same path integral twice and mod squaring it. So this is, in the case where I look at a diagonal matrix element, then this is just the mod squared of the previous path integral. So I'm not moving on. Yeah, so this is the mod squared of that one. So the mod squared of that one is this one, but I can also look at off-diagonal elements in this formalism of the double path integral. Any questions? Does that make sense? Okay, so now we're going to look at an open quantum system. So I have now an open quantum system as before, when I'm looking at the density matrix, but now I want to have some decoherence. And this is called was done by Feynman and Verdon. We're probably people in quantum information theory will be more familiar with the Lindblad equation, but they're mostly equivalent. So for example, what we do now is we just add an interaction term between the bra field and the phi and the ket field. So for example, this interaction term here, and this, if you're familiar with Lindblad equations, this will look very much like a Lindbladian, because it has, so you can think of like the plus x on the left and the minus x on the right of a density matrix. So this is like the jump term, and this is like the no event terms. Are people here familiar with the Lindblad equation? Or the Feynman-Vernon path integral? Okay. If you're familiar with one, then you'll figure out the other. If you're familiar with neither of them, I'm sorry.
Do you know why the path integral approach to open system dynamics has generally not been used to study open system dynamics?
Yes.
Because it certainly gets a lot less use than the Lindblad form. So like, what Yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah, so actually, I think one of the contributions of the work that we'll put online is that it solves, I think, the main reason why people don't use it, which is you cannot check positivity very easily in the path integral approach. So you see all people using all kinds of path integrals which are not completely positive. You can, if you start with a completely positive master equation, then exponentiate it. So it has to be quadratic in the momentum. If it's quadratic in the momentum, you can exponentiate it, and then you know it's positive. But you know it's positive because you knew it was a positive, completely positive trace preserving master equation, and that's how you know it's positive. If you just look at the path integral, it's very difficult to tell. And I guess one of the contributions is we found a way to tell for a lot of these.
So the constraint, you have to articulate the equivalent of, you know, what is Lindblad form in terms of that action.
That's right. Exactly.
I see.
Yeah.
And you hadn't done that before.
Right.
Okay.
I'm not an expert in this, so that's my understanding from talking to people like Robert Elitsky as to why it's not so used. But it's beautiful. And in fact, if you write it like this, you see it's even more beautiful, right? So what's beautiful about the Feynman-Vernon form is that now you see this interaction. Why is it causing decoherence? Because any time the catch field is different to the bra field, if you're picking two matrices which have very different ket and bra values, then this will be cause that to be suppressed. Okay, so that suppresses off-diagonal terms. That's what this Feynman-Vernon term does. Okay, just makes it decay to zero if they're different. So now I'm going to take you to another kind of path integral. Have people heard of like classical path integrals? Mostly they're boring. That's why you don't talk about them very often. So here's a classical path integral. It's just a single path. It's a delta function. We sum over all paths that satisfy Hamilton's equations. So there's Hamilton's equations in the delta function. So Q dot is psi h dot p. And the force has to be given by the potential. And so that's a very boring path integral because there's only one path which satisfies Hamilton's equations given in a particular initial condition. And so the probability of having a final value for Q and P conditioned on a initial point in phase space will be a delta function, right? And that's why we don't often talk about classical path integrals, except if we add stochasticity. So if we have like Brownian motion or a some kind of stochastic process, then you can get paths and you can sum over the paths, right? So for example, I start off with, here's the path integral for Brownian motion. You can see that even though the Q dot has to obey Hamilton's equations, the force is fluctuating here in some sense, or is acting as if the force is fluctuating. So paths p dot which differ from satisfying Hamilton's equations will be suppressed by this Gaussian term. So this will, the closer you are to satisfying Hamilton's equations, the higher the probability you will have in that path. But if you go very far away from Hamilton's equations, then you get suppressed.
Exponentially suppressed.
And this goes by the name of Onsager-Matchloop path integral. Questions?
I assume that normally, like it's not as if Onsager or Matchloop were the first to study stochastic dynamics. That normally, if I have like a fluctuating external potential, I can define that as part of the Hamiltonian and do a Liouville distribution, propagate the Liouville distribution in the usual way with like something like Fokker-Planck equation or something like that. And so it's the particular choice of saying no, we're going to take the Hamiltonian to not include the fluctuations that
look like a path. Yeah, there's lots of equivalent ways of discussing stochastic dynamics from, Itô equation, Fokker-Planck, Itô formalism, Brownian motion, Fokker-Planck. So this comes after Fokker-Planck, obviously, but they were, I guess, writing down this path integral. So I mean, There's another name for it, which I'll cite later, and which I've forgotten, but which is used for, the literature is quite, as you might imagine, it's just very overlapping. So I don't know. So this is just, this is kind of the path-integral part of it.
You could have. It seems to be the relevant thing here is that we are not imagining the fluctuations to be changing the nature of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is fixed, and we are imagining the fluctuations to be something like something else that is not described by the Hamiltonian.
You could say the same thing about the Fokker-Planck equation. You know, if you have a trajectories approach, then you actually imagine there's a noise source, and you can write down the noise source and think of fluctuations. If you then average over that noise source, you will end up with either the Fokker-Planck equation or this path integral. So in both cases, I would say what you attribute the fluctuations to, whether it's the fluctuating Hamiltonian or something else, well, there's lots of equivalent ways of doing that. And the history, Langevin fits in there somewhere as well, Brownian motion, there's all these things, and they all fit in there.
So you can formally write Hamiltonian with a random term. If you put the same, so H plus random Hamiltonian in the other picture where you also have like a J integral and then just do some tricks and you end up with this, and then you can go back by changing the Gaussian into something which looks then stochastic Hamiltonian. I think they should be the same. Mm.
Right. Okay.
It's strange to me that you're putting the stochasticity into the Hamiltonian and not into sort of saying we're considering a distribution in phase space to beginning in order to try to figure out the likelihood of being in a different distribution in phase space.
I'm doing that, aren't I? I mean,
I think that would be very different, because there you say your only ignorance is about the initial configuration, but here he wants to say that the ignorance is about what dynamics got applied. It's more like a random walk.
Yeah, I mean, here I don't have an epistemic restriction, so even if the initial distribution is, say, some probability distribution, I still know, it was here, and then it was there. So I still can follow the exact trajectory of a point in phase space. So I'm not assuming it.
What this is an expression for is the dynamics only, and it's kind of saying nothing about what the distribution or the initial configuration is. If I have a point distribution, the initial configuration, I apply this kind of to it. If I have a distribution, I apply this to it, but it's all about the nature of the dynamics.
Yeah, you can put the distribution in here if you want, or here I'm just looking at it. You know, the path integral starts at a particular point. Okay, so now this is the big one, and I'm going to compare it to the other ones. Here's the classical quantum path integral. This is just a very simple example of it. So here we have the ordinary quantum part, so meaning that we have the Bra and Ket path integrals, unitary evolution. We have the Feynman-Vernon term, okay? It might be a different one, but we have some Feynman-Vernon term. So that's that part here. And now this is the CQ, this is the back reaction term, right? And the diffusion term together. And you can see that it looks very similar to the classical Brownian motion path integral. It has a P dot plus the force, or minus the force. And we're taking a Gaussian distribution over that, so it allows fluctuations. So here it's also P dot plus the force, but it's the average of the left ket and the right, the force is measured by the left ket and the right ket. Okay? So it's very similar, but it's looking at both the Bra and the ket. So when I go look at for the diagonal part, it's exactly the same as the classical stochastic path integral, but more generally, in paths where the left field and the right field are differing, it depends on the average of them. The Feynman-Vernon term is decohering the force when the force is different depending on the ket. So it's decohering the off-diagonal elements of the density matrix where the quantum system is producing different forces, so it'll decohere it. And it has to satisfy what we were talking about at the beginning, which is this decoherence versus diffusion. Trade-off. And it has to satisfy this in order for the dynamics to be completely positive trace preserving, right? So the decoherence term, there should be a lot of diffusion if you want to maintain long coherence times. Any questions about this? We'll put the paper on the archive hopefully by the end of the week, but I'm happy to send it to anyone else.
I am missing in front of the SQ in your equation.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, so the main difference between, one of the differences between these other parts is that they're, real. Whereas the quantum, the purely quantum part is oscillating, as it is imaginary. Notice this almost looks like the stationary phase of this. Like if we wanted to find where this is maximized, we would look at the stationary point, and so we would extremize this, which roughly is this. I've written it in phase space, but you could just as well write it in configuration space, the configuration space path.
Sorry, I missed that point.
I mean, this looks, looks very similar to. I'm writing it out as Hamilton's in terms of Hamilton phase space, but I could write it out in configuration space, in which case this would look like Q double dot, and it would look like the Euler-Lagrange equations, the thing here. So you're diffusing around a solution to the Euler-Lagrange equations rather than diffusing around a solution to...
I see, okay.
Which is nice because we often are told the story that this that the part that the path that dominates is the one where I extremize this action. So, but here it's already extremized, but in a Gaussian distribution. Okay, so I'll get to the interpretation now, and I'm 15 over.
So we try to.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty flexible on time, so no one's needed.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was.
Whatever you consider courteous.
I'll just. Yeah, I'm going to just flash up the. I'll just do two lines and finish it. I'm really sorry. I actually didn't pay attention.
In principle, I'll give an hour and a half for everything. So.
Right.
You're on
the circuit. Okay, I'm just going to. Good. So let's go back to this. So I'm going to just talk about what I'm interested in terms of interpretational issues, which is that there's something quite miraculous which happens when you saturate the trade-off. So we had this trade-off which we needed to satisfy in order to be completely positive trace preserving. If you saturate the trade-off, so something kind of miraculous happens. And the miracle that happens is, let me actually go back here, is that notice that this has the form of a plus field, which is, there's only a small amount of interaction between the plus field and the bra and the ket field, which occurs when you expand the square here, there will be a term which is a coupling between the right field and the left field. Likewise here, there's a term which couples the right and left field. That's like the jump term in Lindbladian dynamics, but it's the coupling between the ket and the bra. When you saturate the trade-off, a little miracle happens and those cancel. So there is no coupling, when you saturate the trade, there is no coupling between the bra field and the ket field. Disappears. And so you can write, you just have an independent action for the bra and a ket. It's independent, they don't talk to each other. Except a little bit through the momentum term, there's coupling to the momentum. They don't directly talk to each other. And so because of that magic, what that means is that the quantum state stays pure the whole time. Okay, so conditioned on the classical degrees of freedom, the quantum state is pure. Even though there's, if I throw away the classical system, then it looks like there's decoherence, which is always the case when you have two coupled systems. But if I conditioned on the trajectory of the classical particle, the quantum state will stay pure. So here's like a toy model of a Stern-Gerlach, and what you find is that the classical particle, so a classical particle, Stern-Gerlach with a spin, and what you find is that the particle measures which spin it is if I start off in the plus state. But remarkably, in the plus state, as the classical particle is measuring the spin, the quantum state stays on the Bloch sphere. And it just zigzags around, moves along the Bloch sphere until it hits either the zero or the one, depending on what the correlated with what the measuring device measured. So, and what's remarkable is that it happens with Born rule probability. So probably given by the Born rule, you'll have a trajectory which collapses to the up or the down state. And the classical system will zip around until it, the classical system zips around, so you can't tell at first whether it's up or down, but eventually you learn that it's up, and by the time you learn that it's up, it's actually moved to the up state, and it's done so through a path which was always pure. And that kind of blew my mind personally. Maybe, I was just expecting that it would decohere. So there's no condition on the classical to freeze, or even, there's no decoherence. And this will be my second last slide. So this is the usual axioms of quantum theory, and we don't like, you know, some people are very uncomfortable because of the various measurement-like postulates which occur. And so the proposal is that we have this CQ interpretation of classical mechanics, or of quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. And the thing that we do here is we just say, I postulate that there are classical systems. I don't tell you what they are. I can't tell you what they are. Just that there exist classical systems. And what you find is that that's all you need to postulate. You will automatically get the Born rule, and you will automatically get like the notion of collapse of the wave function for free. And that may not be a big step in the sense that, you know, there's still the big explained thing, why are there classical systems? You know, I might think the thoughts in my head are classical, the things I write down on a piece of paper when I'm an experimentalist are classical, gravity, maybe the space-time metric is classical, but there are, you know, I don't know what they are, but there are things which are classical, and given that, you know, quantum classical mechanics looks nice, it's just a dynamical theory where things evolve. Classical things are coupled to quantum things, and you don't need any other machinery of measurement or Born rule or anything like that. And so for me, at least, it put it on a kind of very similar setting, a similar framework to quantum mechanics and classical, sorry, like unitary quantum mechanics. And classical mechanics, you get just like a very kind of uniform description of all those different theories without measurement being mentioned. And the only mystery becomes why are there, you know, what is a classical object? What do you mean by a classical object? Do you mean effectively classical? Do you mean actually classical? So it says that the so-called measurement problem, the only problem, I think this shows that the only problem is why are there classical objects? Why are there objects we can treat classically? And I'm over time, so I'm just going to end there and thank you for your attention.
Questions from the room?
I have some, but I'm going to let other people ask questions because I've been asking a lot already.
I mean, I can ask him questions every day. And also, his PhD is up.
So then, any questions from the remote participants? Jeffrey?
I guess maybe one thing actually that came into my mind with this is, suppose this classical system is an effectively classical system, so it becomes from quantum comes classical, then in order to have this preservation of the purity, it will also have to satisfy the diffusion, the coherence trade-off. It would also have to saturate diffusion and coherence. Is there, like, do we know, like, how likely is that happen if the classical system is an effective classical system?
I mean, if you want to say it's an effectively classical system, then it'll just be like approximations to. I mean, there's, you know, I presented it here as a fundamental theory. If you want to think of it as an effective theory, then there are various steps, you know, one can go through to see how close it is. So what we find actually is that there are slight differences to the fundamental theory, particular on Markovianity. So at very longer times, it'll look like this. The effective theory will look like this theory, the fundamental theory, but at short times, it will not. And there's a few other minor different, like there's a subset of theories which cannot be described by it, and there's a subset of theories which can.
Question. I'm trying to understand intuitively the result of you saturate your trade-off. It stays pure. And I'm thinking of it in terms of it feels like, as long as different pure states get coupled to different classical states, kind of increasing the spread of classical states will lead to decoherence. So I would expect those to be locked, the diffusion of the decoherence. And so the only situation where I would expect to have a breaking of that is it would have sort of extra diffusion among the classical stuff that kind of doesn't preserve the correlation to the quantum system. So my first question is that intuition at all sound right?
I mean, I don't know that I have. I'll be honest. I can kind of see it from the equations more easily. Like you see it right away from the path integral that just that you suddenly cancel all the interaction terms. You're probably most likely to get it from the trajectories paper because we actually first found it in the trajectories paper with Isaac Layton and Zach. So if you're a trajectories person, you can kind of see it better. More like, I guess the way. So what we find there is that if let's say that you have too much decoherence. So you kind of oversaturate the equation the other way by having too much decoherence. Then you can kind of almost have like a Church of the Larger Hilbert space approach where you just
oversaturate. You don't mean violate the condition.
Yeah, you don't violate the condition, but you have more additional sources of decoherence.
So the way you preserve the condition is I just can't remember which way the inequality goes.
It's right.
By increasing the decoherence relative to the diffusion. Second, I got that right.
Yeah, it's something like, it's like D2, was it like a D1, oh gosh, and then I think there's like a D0 minus 1.
I thought you were talking about there's an inequality that showed up in your later slide that was just between D2 and D0.
Yeah, so I that was because I had picked these to be 1, so let's do that. So let's fix those.
Okay, so you can't make. Oh, I see. It's a D not.
I can make them both. I could give you just additional. I could give you additional decoherence or additional.
For a given diffusion rate, I can make the decoherence bigger, and for a given decoherence rate, I can make the diffusion
rate
bigger.
Right.
Those are two ways of moving away from saturation.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, that's what was unclear, but okay, I got it now. Okay.
Okay.
So you can consider that way.
I may have, and maybe because I think I will check, but it may be at one point there's a notational thing which might have made it a bit more confusing. That's the thing. So you can imagine that you just add in more decoherence or you add in more diffusion, and then you can think of like a Church of a Larger phase space or a Church of a Larger Hilbert space where you then take that back by enlarging your Hilbert space so that it's pure. So that may be one way to think about it and think, oh, if there's, I mean, that doesn't get you all the way there, but that's kind of maybe one intuition.
We do have a question from online. Francesca?
I don't know if I understood this, but I have a question about locality. Is this local, this theory? Is this like in Bell scenarios? Yeah.
So I guess it's... in general, yes. In general, it is. There are these different kernels which we tried to... which we try to probe and experiment. And there's one we call ultra-local, meaning that there's no... so there's local in the sense of, causal structure. Like, I can't superluminally... The theory doesn't allow superluminal signaling, and local observables evolve locally. So this theory, all the theories that we're looking at the whole parameter space satisfies that form of locality. There's another kind of locality where you might say, am I allowed to have correlations in the diffusion, for example? So diffusion is happening. Can I have diffusion which is correlated in space? So that is like a kind of, it's still local in the sense that there's no signaling, but you are allowed correlation of noise. And so there are theories which have that kind of non-locality, I guess.
Okay, so but nothing in the EA influences there, just have the correlation, but nothing.
Right, nothing other than that.
Collapse theories and Bohmian mechanics where you can have weird.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, there are subtleties with how people talk about locality in those theories, but this theory is definitely local.
Thanks.
Another question. Stuff you said at the end, I would like to know, so in the literature on collapse theories, people imagine, you know, not only stochastic modifications of Schrodinger's equation, but they also tend to think, you know, like people like Philip Pearl say, well, let's imagine there's a classical fluctuating degree of freedom, which is what causes, is kind of the source of these continuous collapses. And in those kinds of models, if I ask what is the quantum state for each value of this fluctuating classical source, I will see that it undergoes a jumpy kind of evolution that stays among the pure states. So it's a pure state evolving in a stochastic way. And you know, just like your picture of the Bloch sphere, that's exactly, I think, what certain versions of continuous collapse theories would look like. The difference being, though, that they don't tend to write down the equations of motion for the classical fluctuating field. They're basically saying it's as if this classical fluctuating field impacts the quantum systems and then flies off and kind of doesn't care what happens next.
Right.
But many of your conclusions didn't seem to depend on that. Like, if you're saying that, oh, I can derive the collapse postulate, well, that's true for these collapse theories as well. They say, well, we don't have to assume the collapse postulate, that's a consequence of the dynamics. So how many of your conclusions on that last slide relied on doing, you know, keeping track of those classical degrees of freedom at future times, and how many are just reproduced by these continuous collapse theories?
So I guess I would say with those continuous collapse theories, you know, this random hitting field is usually, as I understand, is not meant to be observable. It's like a fictitious, I mean, I think most people think of it as a fictitious thing, like it's just quantifying something that happens.
That's true. I think that many collapse theorists think of it as a real field that maybe in the future we have to sort of say, in the future we would be able to talk about it. But yeah, they imagine it's real, it's out there, it has a value. If we could measure its value, you know, we would find it to be perfectly correlated with the pure quantum state that is evolving in this fluctuating way.
Right.
They think of it as fictitious, they think of it as real.
Well, it's not something that can get, there's no back reaction. It doesn't get acted upon by, at least I don't know of any examples where it gets acted upon by the, so, and that's here is what's doing.
Modeling it in a way where they say, well, because we don't know what this field is and how it works, we're not going to try to keep track of its dynamics.
Right.
That's a different project.
And
we're just going to sort of say, how does it impact the quantum system?
Right.
And so it's kind of like, often in physics, we sort of say, okay, let's treat that thing as something that's not suffering back reaction. So I say that they're definitely not treating its back action.
Right.
For many of them, I think that's sort of like tentative. Like, oh, if we get clear on what the order of this field, we can do that, but for the moment, we're just trying to solve the measurement problem.
Right.
So let's get down to business.
Right. So I...
So much better. It really says the back reaction substitutes for measurement.
Well, and it's the back reaction which is causing the so-called collapse. So if I understand collapse models, usually it's like there's a field, it hits it, and then it causes it to collapse with a probability which is given by the Born rule Y. You know, you're not, in my view, you're not really simplifying the thing. You're just constructing a kind of, I don't know, a framework around it to explain it in a different way, is my view. Like, you're still saying it hits and it happens to hit with a probability given by the Born rule Y. So here we don't put that in. It's just like, and it's the back reaction is the crucial part. If there's no back reaction, then there's no need for any of this to happen. It's crucially the fact that the system interacts with this classical field, pushes back on it, and it's that what's causing it to, you know, take one of these trajectories.
So this is like the meter, like the classical meter, seeing a needle here versus seeing the needle there before and after the measurement.
Right, right, right. But you don't need to talk about it as a measuring thing. It's just a classical system which undergoes standard linear interaction like anything else. So and that just feels like a more natural way to describe what we're doing. Even if we don't really know yet why some things we treat classically and strikingly, it's just like, no, there are classical objects, there are quantum objects, they interact. This is the only way they can really interact. And it will look like everything that we try to describe as measurement and collapse looks like this. But, you know, I think in the main, maybe to answer your question, I don't need to postulate all these things that I think you need to postulate for collapse models. I'm not, there certainly are things that in that literature that are relevant. So I'm not like, and I should also say that like this notion of that classicality somehow causes decoherence, that's, I'm not the first to claim that. So, you know, I think it goes back to Hall and Dioshi and Tilloy and David Poulin. So I think people knew that classical objects, if they interact, will cause Milburn, et cetera. They knew that it would cause some decoherence. I think what's new here is that it's actually a unique path and that you can actually derive everything from it, that you get the Born rule, basically. That's the kind of new thing. So I'm not sure how much new I'm, like, I feel like it's, for me, it's much clearer, but I don't know, maybe everyone knew that, oh, the whole mystery is why are there classical objects? But for me, at least, it kind of makes the question a bit more precise about what the measurement problem is in quantum theory. It's only why are there classical objects.
So this would also prohibit any interesting question around Wigner's friend, right? Because it's saying there's no notion of modeling the friend modeling Wigner in superposition. There's just, he's uncertain about the classical state. But we're treating Wigner as a classical system, which has its own rules, its own dynamics.
Yeah. I mean, you might argue with someone. I feel like you might argue with someone as to why should I treat Wigner's friend, who's just a collection of atomic particles, just like everything else. Why are we, you know? So I don't have any opinion on that, in the sense that I don't know why Wigner's friend we should treat as a classical object. So I guess there's, you know, I think if you are someone who believes in many worlds, you might argue that we need to now explain why these objects which we treat as effectively classical, and so this is just some approximate. This is just a good way of doing it, but the mystery is why do we treat this classical? I do think that there's a legitimate case to be made that space-time and the time between clocks is a precondition for doing quantum theory, and therefore is a valid, you know, is reasonable. You know, it's not crazy to imagine that that could be fundamentally classical. But who knows? I don't have any more clue than anyone else.
Okay, that was a lot of fun. We can keep the conversation going at lunch. Thank you very much.